You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
Atomic Insights.
Hi, Shane.
Hi, Rod.
This is Rod, coming to you from Annapolis, Maryland, for Atomic Show number 10.
All right. Well, this is Shane Brown from Las Lomas, New Mexico. And we had some follow-ups from last week and some interesting news about a side issue with all the new nuclear plant orders that countries and economies are getting very interested in.
Yep. Well, I was proud of my home state of Florida, a company that I have a lot of long-lived ties to, Florida Power and Light Company, announced this week that they're going to put their bid in or put get their place in line at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for a combined operating license. I think they plan to apply in 2008.
You got to wonder what those poor commissioners at the NRC are thinking right now. I mean, my cup runneth over.
Well,
seems to be the order of the day. And it just took those first few people going out on a limb to say, hey, we're willing to continue the trend we started, to continue the good idea. And it seemed like it literally started the bandwagon.
Well, you know, there's a lot of publications that I read back in the day that talked about the era of the late 1960s, early 1970s, as a bandwagon market in nuclear power. And I think that the utility industry tends to move as a herd.
So the question is, what is a herd of, buffalo or cows?
Well, I think that they've done a lot of thinking. They've done a lot of talking to each other. The plans have been being laid for a number of years. The reactor vendors, Westinghouse and General Electric and Areva, have all been working on their third-generation designs, and they've come up with some very nice saleable designs. They're understandable by the utilities.
Not to mention being simpler than the second generation, right?
Oh, absolutely. They're simpler, use less components, should be able to be constructed on a schedule that can be adhered to. I won't say that they're any safer. I think that the existing plants are so safe that I can't imagine being any safer. But the difference is that they're safer with less effort. They're
yes.
easier safe.
Which is always good to hear. I remember reading in one of the latter chapters in Ted Rockwell's new book, The Opening the Nuclear World. I can't remember the exact title, but it's on my bookcase. I just can't get to it right now. Creating the New World, the First Atomic Age. And in the latter part of that book, he goes into quite a bit of detail on the different factors that come into play when you look at simplifying current plant designs. And he has much the same thought, is that the plants don't need to be any safer. They're already literally as safe as we have ever made any industrial facility on the planet Earth. It's that, how can we achieve that safety at a lower cost and lower number of components? And some of the percentage reductions in complexity were pretty amazing, 30 to 40% reductions in part counts and systems counts, and a lot more reliance on basic things like having several swimming pools worth of water, several dozen swimming pools worth of water above the reactor, with valves that have to be held closed to keep them from flooding the reactor.
One of the nice things about the passively safe or easier safe designs is that the reactors can demonstrate safety without reliance on, say, off-site power. One of the things that's always kind of amused me or frustrated me is that I know that our nuclear reactors are very resistant to wind storms. They have very strong resistance to that kind of thing. However, because of the fact that the second generation plants are required to have a certain amount of power coming from off-site in order to provide heat removal in case of an issue, the plants had to shut down when a hurricane was coming. It doesn't seem like the right thing to do, as far as I'm concerned. I like keeping the power on while hurricanes are coming.
Absolutely. And I can definitely speak from personal experience on how ominous it can be to have a power off and have even a minor, quote-unquote, hurricane approaching you. But interesting that you should mention the requirement for off-site power. As I recall, there was a online book that several people have mentioned in their various blogs. It's called raddecision.blogspot.com. It is written by a boiling water reactor, BWR, plant engineer as a techno-thriller. And it went through the a plausible accident that pretty much hurt nobody. So it was kind of like another Three Mile Island, but it was a lot more, it had lots of twists and turns in the plot that made it more interesting to read than a TMI summary.
Yeah, the TMI summary just is a kind of a comedy of error plot.
Yeah. Let's see, the light bulbs burned out. We had everything that could have gone wrong, went wrong. If only those people had that kind of luck when they were playing poker, it'd be like 12 straight flushes in a row.
Well, you know, another implication, you mentioned the issues that the nuclear regulatory commissioners are going to have in filling their ranks, filling the number of people that it's going to take to review all these new applications. I think the figure right now is that the NRC expects to hire approximately 350 people per year for the next 5 to 10 years. So they intend to grow quite a bit.
Will they be hiring engineers, or will they be hiring civil servants?
Well, they'll be hiring some engineers.
In terms of civil servants, I mean people who are kind of like what happened with NASA. The previous administrator of NASA, Sean O'Keefe, actually came into NASA with no technical experience. He was the unkind term would be bean counter in the office of OMB, which is the accountancy, the accountants division of the U.S. federal government. And he came into NASA and did some things right, and some things he just, the technical justifications weren't there in any way, shape, or form, and that was one of the reasons why he ended his tenure early.
Yeah, I believe that the NRC has got a pretty good plan in place to hire specialists in a number of areas, but it's not going to be just nuclear engineers. For example, one of the areas where they think that they're going to need some significant help from other industries or people experienced in other industries is in their building inspector equivalents. When the plants actually start construction, they're going to have on-site inspectors that verify that the plants are being built according to their design. And, of course, they haven't actually monitored the construction of a new plant in quite some time. So that's
one. There's very few people who are around who know how to do that and have the on-the-job training that they learned when they did it.
Correct. But, of course, there are other large, complex construction projects that have occurred, and many of those have very detailed regulatory requirements. You know, if you're building a chemical plant and whatnot, or they have people that have built with very exacting specifications. I think that, for example, fab facilities for making microchips probably is a very detailed and by-the-book process.
Especially considering the chemicals that they handle.
Well, that and the
semiconductor fabs handle some of the most noxious chemicals of any industry in the U.S., bar none.
Right. And again, a fabrication facility for microprocessors is going to require investment very similar to that for a nuclear power plant, in the several billion dollars.
Yep. Here in just north of here, there's a suburb of Albuquerque called Rio Rancho, and that's actually where Intel has one of their fabs, and they put it in about 10 years ago, and it was a $1 billion facility. And it is the one of the largest employers in the Albuquerque area. They employ something like 4,000 or 5,000 people.
Well, that's another thing that I wanted to mention tonight. Today is one of the reasons that I'm trying to share as much information about this, what we see as a huge potential market, is that there's going to be a real need for talented people to man this new industry. Hopefully, some of the people that have been, maybe downsized in other manufacturing enterprises will recognize that this might be something to retrain for.
What would the retraining requirements be to get into the nuclear industry compared to, say, some of the other industries that they might be considered? Would the retraining requirements be higher in some respects or lower in some respects?
Well, the interesting thing is that the retraining will be difficult. There's no doubt about it.
Oh, yeah.
Working in the nuclear industry is hard. Yeah, working in the nuclear industry is a very exacting field, high standards. But the good thing is that the industry is very used to training people. It works very hard, very diligently to provide the opportunity for people to learn how to do their job. It gives them plenty of time to study, and it will reward those kind of hardworking people that have done things like, build high quality cars or have worked in process industries like the steel or aluminum industry or those kinds of things, chemical manufacturers. Those people that have operated those plants are going to be real good nuclear plant operators if they get some training.
Atoms are atoms. It's just a matter of what you're shoving and how you're shoving them.
Well, speaking of atoms are atoms, one of the topics that we talked about at the end of our last show was the idea that has been mainly a result of research done by a man named Dr. Herndon. And Dr. J. Marvin Herndon has been writing papers and doing research on what he calls the georeactor for about the last 20, 25 years.
It's a really fascinating concept. It's an explanation for certain irregularities that a lot of people of his persuasion, scientists who are geophysicists, people who study the physics of the Earth and who describe models of how the Earth's interior works, like, for instance, how what drives volcanoes, how hot the Earth's interior is, things like that. And the theory that he's proposing, and he has quite a bit of evidence to back it up, is that at the center of the Earth, there is actually an operating natural nuclear reactor, similar to the one that we mentioned a few shows ago that operated in Oklo in Africa, except that it is much, much bigger. There would be a sphere of natural uranium and thorium with some other materials mixed in because it's natural and fissioning at an inconstant rate. And the rate at which, and the varying rate at which that ball of uranium and thorium beneath all of our feet would run, the reactor at, would be responsible for things like the Earth's magnetic field changing polarity, south and compasses suddenly pointing south and then turning north again every 700,000 years.
Well, does that really happen suddenly, or is it something that happens, at least from a human's point of view, relatively slowly? Seems like that reactor probably operates very close to constant power unless something happens that maybe causes it to get a little hot. And when it gets a little too hot, what happens in a normal reactor is the rate of reaction starts to slow down.
Yep.
or if it gets a little too cold, maybe it ejects some material or something that would cause the reactor to speed back up again to regain the temperature at which it's critical.
Well, there's a lot of theory behind the papers, and I've myself have only read the barest outlines of the paper, but and Dr. Herndon can email in or correspond with us to correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like one of the reasons why the georeactor was chosen in favor and over the alternative explanations, which are the Earth slowly contracting over a very long period of time, combined with the radioactive materials beneath us in the Earth that keep it warm, those processes are very, very steady. And a reactor would have the capability to run in a pulsed mode, pulsed over long time periods, could be over hundreds of thousands of years. But the pulsing nature, or the possibility of pulsing in the reactor, is one of the reasons why he chose it.
So the other thing that's interesting is that this reactor is not just a fission reactor. It is a reactor that has the ability to convert uranium-238 into fuel. Because
of the breeder.
It is a breeder. By the configuration that has been proposed, the reactor operates and can continue operating over a 4 billion year period because it is slowly converting the uranium-238 into additional fuel. And the paper that we'll put up a link to it on the blog is very detailed and shows how Dr. Herndon has run the numerical simulations through the same kind of calculations used to design land-based fission reactors, you know, so the proven codes, and the theory holds up. Pretty impressive to me to think about the fact that 4 billion years ago, when the ratio of uranium-235 to uranium-238 was significantly higher than it is today, this reactor started going, and because there was enough material there, it was able to be converting steadily the uranium-238 into fuel. So as the 235 got depleted, the 238 would be converted to plutonium and actually continue the reaction. It's just it's what I like to emphasize is not really a breeder reactor, it's a converter reactor. Yeah, it just is a very steady process, and an amazing thing to think about, this constant generation of power over that long a period of time.
A fission star.
Well, you know, the paper that Dr. Herndon has written indicates that the theory can explain some things that have previously been almost mysteries in interstellar world. And, you know, people talk about the missing mass in the constellations or in the solar system. I'm not a space guy.
The missing mass problem is that the galaxy that the Earth's solar system, our solar system, is situated in, along with 400 billion other stars, is turning too rapidly and is behaving like it has about 10 times as much mass as we can see. There's too much gravity, and they can only account for about 10% of it. The rest of it is completely invisible. It's what they call dark matter.
And so if more matter in the solar system or the galaxy is metallic and higher density materials.
And that would nicely explain a lot of weird things that astronomers have been seeing for the last 50 years.
Right. Astronomers have assumed that most things were gaseous, if I remember the theories correctly.
They've come up with a bunch of different theories, including that it may be that most of the missing mass in the universe that is causing things to behave so subtly different than they expect is coming from Another particle that Dr. Herndon makes use of, and his opponents also make use of, a particle called a neutrino.
Now, how do his opponents make use of this neutrino to be opponents, I guess?
Well, one of the critical questions on which Dr. Herndon's theory seems to turn is whether or not there is a very large flux of neutrinos coming off of the georeactor at the center of the Earth. And all nuclear reactions produce neutrinos. Neutrinos are very, very light particles that move very quickly, and they're notable for two things. Number one, they're extremely light. They're the lightest particles that we know of next to light, which has no mass, light particles. And number two, they interact with matter extremely rarely. Every second, whether it's day or night, something like a billion neutrinos from the sun are passing through each eyeball of every human being on the Earth, and they fly through the Earth as though it were glass. It would take 9 trillion miles of lead, a light year of lead, in order to stop a beam, 50% of a beam of neutrinos. They're very, very difficult to find, but there are enough of them that scientists have constructed what are called neutrino telescopes, which involves going down into a mine and setting up a bag of water or chemicals in a very, very dark room and surrounding it with light detectors. And by looking at the pattern of light, the small light flashes that form whenever a neutrino happens by dumb luck to come across some atom of material, and when they come to a stop, it's usually with a bang. They can tell not only what type of neutrino it was, but what kind of nuclear reaction it came from and from what direction it came. And the proponents and the opponents of the theory are both looking at some neutrino detectors that are being built as we speak and or that exist by being converted over to do the experiments to look for antineutrinos, neutrinos that come from fission, to be coming from the center of the Earth in the quantities that Dr. Herndon's theory predicts, as opposed to normal neutrinos, which come from the sun in the billion per second per eyeball number that I quoted earlier. So it's a matter of where they're coming from and whether there's enough of them to justify claiming a fission reactor is providing them rather than just ordinary radioactive decay, which also produces antineutrinos.
Well, you know, I did some more reading and found an article from 2004 in the San Francisco Chronicle that talked about a group of folks that were trying to persuade the Dutch government to fund a test that would test this geo-reactor theory on the island of Curaçao. It would be drilling a shaft more than 1,000 feet deep into Curaçao. Now, here's the interesting thing. It seems like these folks want to spend $80 million to try to disprove the theory.
Well, if $80 million, that will definitely advance the state of the art and the science. And if they're proven wrong, well, they're out $80 million. And if they succeed, well, that's science. But really, there's a lot of indirect evidence, but one of the few pieces of direct evidence I can think of would be to turn on such a detector and find a very serious flux of antineutrinos coming up from the center of the Earth. And if you did it at multiple places on the Earth, and at each place on the Earth, the neutrino flux was more or less perpendicular to the surface and had the same energy no matter where you tested it on the Earth, it would point to all of them coming from the core. And there being enough of them to justify thinking, hey, there's something going on down there.
But, you know, I guess I'm not much of a scientist, because when I see this, the theory seems to hold together far better and explain far more things than the existing theory, which is some sort of molten mass of nickel and something else. I don't know what else.
Yeah, but it's just radioactive decay combined with the Earth contracting slowly is what people have been thinking it was.
Right. Well, you know, it just seems to me that this theory holds together. It seems logical. It seems to explain things that aren't explained.
For instance, the fact that the really big planets in our solar system, like Jupiter and Saturn, the large planets in the solar system actually produce more energy than they receive from the sun, based on measurements of infrared heat energy emissions that planets make with telescopes that are in orbit and at high altitude. It's pretty easily detectable that Jupiter and Saturn and Neptune all generate more energy and radiate it out to space than they receive from the sun.
So these planets could also have
geo-reactors, much larger geo-reactors that would explain the very large energy fluxes coming off of them. And curiously enough, the fourth outer planet, though it's the third one in order, Uranus, which is also tilted on its side, doesn't do that. It does not produce more energy than it receives from sunlight. So it's possible that whatever knocked it on its side and has it rolling around the solar system like a bowling ball also managed to knock the georeactor that was inside of it out.
Snuffed that thing right out, huh?
So, who knows? It's science, and it's always interesting to watch, although science is definitely not engineering.
Okay, so let me ask you a question there, Mr. Scientist, or at least you're more interested than I, because I really care more about, producing energy and that kind of stuff. But anyway, is there any direct evidence for the previously existing theories?
There was, but there was a lot of inconsistencies with the theory. And those inconsistencies are, I believe, what Dr. Herndon is addressing with the georeactor theory. And his papers and what I've read of him in the popular press, it definitely seems to fit the facts. But there are a lot of people who think that the theory is kind of far-fetched.
Okay, so here's Dr. Herndon, who was a college professor, and apparently sometime in the, maybe around 1980 or so, was unable to obtain any grants or funding for continuing his research, or the way I read between the lines, he didn't get tenure,
right.
So he moved into other professions. So his theory was far enough away from the mainstream that he wasn't able to advance in the academic world.
Yep, that seems to be how I understand the situation. And of course, he can correct us if we're wrong. But that's oftentimes the case in science, is that when you break new ground, really, really, really new ground, a lot of science tends to look down on it. And it's happened before, and it'll happen again.
Well, here's another question that I guess I'm also a cynic, or always looking for the hidden motives. I was an English major, so I'm always analyzing is what they're really trying to say. So what seems to me to have happened here is that there are many people that strongly resist the concept that there could possibly be a natural fission reactor heat source still operating here on Earth. And these are maybe the same people who tell us, well, why should we build these unnatural fission reactors on Earth? We'll just collect our energy from that natural fusion reactor called the sun.
That's an extremely good point. And it's a point I've often thought about when I've looked at the opinions that people raise about the georeactor theory. And what a lot of people don't realize is that the sun is really bad in efficiency-wise at producing energy per unit mass. The sun produces about 4 × 10^26 watts of thermal power output, which is the equivalent of over 4 million tons of mass disappearing every second into the right side of the E=mc² equation, and it comes out the other side as light. But if you look at the mass of the sun is 10 with 30 zeros after it, kilograms. If you divide the power by the mass, that's a 10,000th of a watt per kilo power to weight ratio or power to mass ratio. And even then, if you assume, okay, the entire sun isn't fusing, it's just the core. There's a wonderful book that an author put out about 20 years ago called The Man-Made Sun by Tom Heppenheimer. He's a big space writer too. And he, at the very beginning of the book, he lays down some calculations that show that the actual energy density in the core of the sun is about 2 watts per ton. That's probably the fusing portion of the sun.
Well, that's probably a good thing, because that means that it's got a lot of fuel and it'll last for an awful lot longer than it has already lasted.
And there are, stars are just like people. There are big ones and there are little ones. And the bigger a star is, the faster it goes through its mass. There are stars that are 10 times the mass of the sun that go through their fuel in a million years. And there are stars 3% or 10% of the mass of the sun that will go through their fuel in much, much longer than the sun is expected to go through it. It's a matter of how highly they can compress the cores, how fast they go through their fuel.
Well, here's another problem with, from my point of view, with collecting energy from the sun, is that we're 93 million miles away from the sun, which means that if you draw a sphere around the sun, that's where the sun's energy is at 93 million miles away.
Yep. And it's, the Earth 1,400 watts per square meter.
Right. And the Earth is a very tiny little spot. So yep. The vast majority of the sun's energy goes someplace else.
Yep. Going off to keep space.
And, of course, the other problem with solar energy, from my point of view, is that we have this thing called night every 24 hours, and we also have winter that causes the sun not to be around very much, and then clouds and rain and fog and mist and lots of other things.
Not to mention the fact that, to my knowledge, there's never been a solar-powered submarine.
Well, to my knowledge, there's never been a solar-powered ship. There's been a few very light solar-powered automobiles that, automobile in the sense of a vehicle that moves by itself.
However, they drive at about 25 or 30 miles an hour tops. They're incredibly hot because they have no air conditioning, and they're about the size of a decent-sized diesel truck in terms of their cross-sectional area viewed from above, but they're flat as a pancake. They weigh like maybe 300 or 400 pounds, and they have about as much power as a hairdryer. They have about 2 horsepower maximum motors.
Yeah, very challenging engineering feat to be able to produce a vehicle that moves by solar power, and I guess that's why there's people that are interested in doing it. I'm a lazy engineer. I like to do things that are really easy and that provide lots of return on investment.
Reminds me of a phrase, to paraphrase one of my favorite books by Ayn Rand. There's a book that she put out called Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. You ever read it?
No. I have read several Ayn Rand books, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged.
This was actually a collection of essays that she did with several other people in the philosophical movement that she founded in the 40s and 50s called Objectivism. And it turns out that one of the contributors to the volume...
Just a minute, hold on.
Hey, sorry for interrupting. It's Cam here from TPN. I need your help, people. We want to ramp up TPN this year. We got brand new servers and brand new infrastructure and brand new software, and we want to ramp up. We need to add hundreds of shows to TPN this year. If you think you've got what it takes to do a regular show on TPN and you want to work with someone who can help you figure out all the technology and business infrastructure that you need, shoot me an email, cameronreilly@gmail.com. Put the subject heading, I want to be a host. And we'll get back to you. Now, back to your originally scheduled podcast.
Okay, Shane.
No problem.
Oh, well. Anyway, so Ayn Rand and objectivism.
Yeah, so it actually turns out that the outgoing chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, wrote a couple essays in this book. And he used to be, way back when, he was in her circle of followers. Or I shouldn't say followers, since they're very, very individualistic people, but in the same group of like-minded people, that capitalism was an ideal. And the title of the book, Capitalism, an Unknown Ideal, and the fact that at the time capitalism was kind of viewed by a lot of people in the academia as being a, at best a necessary evil and at worst something that was actively bad, when in actual fact it's pretty good system of distributing scarce resources. And this phrase popped into my head a couple of years ago when I was looking at the cover of this book. It just replaced capitalism with fission. Fission, the unknown ideal, where everybody keeps hoping that we'll be able to bring Starfire to Earth and solve all of fission's quote-unquote problems, when really those problems have been blown completely out of proportion. And we have the energy source that we need provided for us.
I agree. And I think that the issue that fission has with some people in terms of its popularity is that it is, in fact, too good. It is. I sometimes like to imagine in my mind trying to persuade somebody that fission in the energy world is sort of like having Shaquille O'Neal show up at a kindergarten basketball court. And the
people think you've got to be cheating.
Well, everybody around looks at this guy who comes in and says, obviously we can't let this guy play by the same rules as a six-year-old. So we've got to put some restrictions on him. We've got to do all we can to try to bring him down so that the game's not unfair. Because obviously, Shaquille O'Neal at a six-year-old basketball game would be able to score at will.
Yep. And that's fundamentally the problem. How do we get people to realize that, A, we're not beating up on six-year-olds, and B, we need it. We need it badly.
Well, we're sorry.
Well, I should say we need it badly. I mean, we need it in terms of it's time for us to move on. If you look at the history of civilization, and you've seen this, and I've seen it, and a bunch of people I know who've written about it, is that the history of civilization is a history of increasing energy density. And we went from natural sources like wind and water and burning wood to coal, then oil, and then natural gas. And we've been kind of stuck in this plateau for a very short period of time compared to how long civilization's been around. And this newcomer has been trying to make its way on stage, and the previous shining stars of the energy world have been reluctant to exit stage left.
But, the coal-fired ship had approximately the same history. The first coal-fired ship to cross the Atlantic was the Savannah. And the Savannah crossed the Atlantic about 50 years before coal overcame sails.
Funny story about the Savannah. The first European ship to see her rushed to her aid thinking that she was on fire.
I can understand that. But, no one rushed to the aid of the second Savannah of equal import. Because
nuclear ship Savannah.
That's right. She didn't have any smoke coming out of her stack at all.
Beautiful ship. Trouble is she was too beautiful.
Not very, economic, but that's okay. The first of a kind
proof
of anything is going to be a very expensive thing. And if you're supporting an entire infrastructure on your own,
it's going to be expensive.
It's going to be expensive.
Not to mention that at the time that the Savannah was floating, diesel fuel, marine-grade diesel fuel was, what, $3 a ton?
Pretty much. It was $3 a barrel, I that time.
Close enough.
Yeah.
Large quantities of oil available very cheaply versus having to have nuclear-trained shore handlers at whatever ports you came into. It was just some of the disadvantages I heard that she had, but everybody, all of the magazine writers and editorial writers that wrote her were always enthralled by just how pleasant it was to be on board her.
Well, I've got a picture. I'm probably going to dig it out someplace and maybe post it on my website, but I had a picture made when I first started Adams Atomic Engines back in the early 90s or mid 90s. And the picture was trying to depict the thought process that made me really believe that it was time to leave the Navy at that time, 1993, and begin a company to build nuclear engines for ships. That was my primary focus at the time. And the thought process was my wife and I went on our 10th anniversary cruise, and we were floating on the Atlantic on our way down to Bermuda. Beautiful day. We're sitting in a hot tub, and I was looking up at the black smoke coming out of the stack and thinking about how that was spoiling the view, and thinking about the submarine that I had just come off how that submarine could go around without producing any smoke at all. I said, I guess it's time to try to share that knowledge. But anyway.
Absolutely.
Maybe it's too.
And one of the numbers about that Savannah was just amazing. I remember Holmes Crouch. I've mentioned him in a few letters, and I've written about him in essays and stuff. And he wrote a couple books back in the 60s. Great, extremely approachable books for even lay people who happen to have a little training in algebra to follow. And the book that he did on commercial ship propulsion used the Savannah as an example in pretty much every chapter. And one of the things that he mentioned was that, well, the Savannah, even with 3 or 4% burn up and with the core loading that we have, can go around the world 20 times.
You know, you're a good straight man. I just got a very interesting email today from one of the readers of Atomic Insights. And this gentleman is a researcher at NASA and has an association with the Naval Postgraduate School. And apparently, possibly based on some of the articles that have been written about nuclear ship propulsion, they found Mr. Crouch and persuaded him to sell his copyright to them. And they have begun a process of scanning the book and converting it to PDF. And this email gave me the first few chapters and gave me permission to post them on Atomic Insights.
Oh, awesome.
So that
I've been looking for a copy of Nuclear Rocket Propulsion, which was the other book that he did back in the 60s, but it's a rare book. The cheapest copy I've ever seen online on any of the used booksellers sells for over $70 a copy.
Well, that's the next response I'm going to give to, and of course, thanking for the initial PDFs for Nuclear Ship Propulsion, and see if they've got the rights to produce the other book. That'd be pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And, well, it looks like we've been talking for close to 45 minutes, and I don't want to put anybody to sleep on this, so I guess we'll call it a week, call it a day, call it the end of a podcast. And I do want to mention to folks that there is at least one other podcast that people who are interested in the Atomic Show should definitely check out, and that's John Wheeler's This Week in Nuclear, and you can find it best by just doing a Google search for that phrase, This Week in Nuclear. John does a good podcast, great podcast, mainly focused on different events that have occurred in the nuclear world over the last week. And his viewpoint is in sometimes a little bit different from mine. His but he's a an active employee at a nuclear power plant and has a long history of experience in the industry and does a pretty darn good show. So check it out.
Absolutely. So I really need to sit down and listen to some of his archive podcasts. But
well, I guess you could, since you don't, you know, carry an iPod to work with you, you could always, you know, sit at your computer and listen to podcasts. But you probably have other things to do.
Or I can burn it to a CD and play it in an MP3 playing CD.
I'll tell you, for me, the whole podcast phenomenon has just been almost a lifesaver because I am on the road at least 3 hours per day, and then I usually spend another hour to hour and a half each day on either a treadmill or a bicycle or a elliptical machine or something at the gym. And having the ability to listen to something other than commercial radio has been just fantastic.
Can't find a better testimonial for podcasts than that.
Yep. So anyway, everyone take care. Have a great week. Go green. Go atomic.
Night all.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
Atomic Insights.